And good morning, everybody, and welcome to today's New Energy Chinwag. We're myself, Charlie Rattan, and we're joined today by John Clipsham up in Orkney. John, welcome to today's Chinwag. And would you like to tell us a little bit about what you've been doing for the last few years up in Orkney?
Well, thanks very much for welcoming me onto this Chinwag, and as this is all done by the powers of the internet, I can tell you that up in Orkney we have got sunshine today. It's absolutely glorious. I've got a nice view view over a very misty island of Hoy, which I can see from the window here. And if I'm interrupted, it's likely to be sheep in the adjoining field. I think they're getting the fleeces shaved off today. Right. So anyway, a bit of an agricultural components to our discussions today. So journey so far, well, certainly of recent years, has been an unbelievable passage from the chemical sector into the rapidly evolving hydrogen sector. I've had a passion for years and years about green chemistry and trying to reduce energy burdens on chemical processes. Hence, I've spent a lot of time working with catalysts and understanding how we can use less energy to affect chemical transitions. So found myself in Orkney for reasons which would take longer than the duration of this chat. And after coming up here doing some consulting work, there was an advert in the paper from the European Marine Energy Centre who were recruiting a hydrogen development manager to enable the local hydrogen projects to be taken further forward and hopefully push the hydrogen agenda. So I applied, was interviewed, and was duly offered a post there, and then spent 2.5 very challenging, very rewarding, and very happy years working with them, pushing forward some of the groundbreaking projects integrating green hydrogen produced from renewable sources through to power, heat, and transport applications. And there is a long list of really innovative, exciting projects that Orkney have been involved in. Part of the role was actually to do a bit of a tourist guide there's hundreds of visitors each year that wanted to come up and explore and understand what the noise was about. What is this hydrogen economy that is being developed? And from that, I think a lot of the seeds were sown, which are now maturing into some of the larger projects that you're starting to see appearing all over the globe right now. So that's how I ended up in the hydrogen world.
You make it sound so easy and so straightforward, but as you said just now, there is indeed a lot of noise around the hydrogen. John Massey and I have talked about it on a number of our podcasts, and why is everybody talking about hydrogen and the various strategies? Every day there seems to be somebody coming up with a strategy or a roadmap or something, and a lot of it is quite impressive scale. They've got great names like Gigastack and Liquid Wind and all these kind of things, but very few people have actually delivered it. And it seems to be that if you were to look, and this is on a global basis, of an example of where a hydrogen economy has actually been delivered rather than talked about, it is indeed Orkney, and that central to that process, you were central to that process.
Well, it's really kind of you to say so. I'm sufficiently modest to accept none of the credit for it. However, yes, I did certainly put a lot of the effort in, but there was a lot of forethought went into the hydrogen economy prior to my involvement. Yes, I had the privilege of driving it forward, but I should doff my cap in the direction of other folk at EMEC and indeed Community Energy Scotland, ITM Power, and one or two others who were heavily involved, as well as the local council. Yeah. So without a team effort, it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah. And for those of us that haven't been up to Orkney, sadly, would you like to tell us a little bit more about what it involves? What is it exactly that Orkney has managed to get up and running and linked together? What bits of the economy constitute a hydrogen economy, if you like?
So the projects up here were born out of an initial PEM, proton exchange membrane electrolyzer, And the idea or the concept was to use that to produce hydrogen as a way of alleviating constraint, initially at EMEC's test center, where they were testing tidal, and they still are testing tidal energy converters. But shortly afterwards, it was recognized that hydrogen had a value, and reconverting the hydrogen back to electricity, certainly when you're located at the end of an electricity grid, as Orkney is, doesn't have a great deal of value. And that's where the other projects were born. So the system up here has got tidal and onshore wind integrated through to electrolysis. There is then compression, hydrogen storage, transportation is a key aspect, and understanding the costs of moving hydrogen around is not a trivial part of the discussion. As is moving the hydrogen in the Orkney system by ferry and getting permission to do that, ensuring that you have got your safety cases well established, the MCA regulations and boxes are ticked, and so on. It's not a trivial exercise at all. And this is one of the, I guess, unwritten lessons learnt from the system, is understanding rules, regulations, policies, and indeed what will need to change as the hydrogen economy expands, not just in Scotland, but much further afield.
Yeah, indeed.
So, to conclude the story, the hydrogen produced then enables you to develop applications, and in Orkney you will currently see a ferry. This has been repurposed to run on dual fuel. There is a heating systems being deployed at one of the schools on another one of the islands. We have got some dual fuel or range extended hydrogen vans which are being run within the infrastructure here. And shortly, I haven't checked the progress on this recently, there should be a hydrogen plane, six-seater plane, arriving to do some demonstration flights around the Isles.
Wow, it seems that just about every aspect is incorporated in this. I mean, if you were to think dispassionately from a kind of a utility point of view, the islands, you touched upon this, are difficult to get electricity to. I suppose you'd need a lot of cable, and you'd be at the end of the network. And I suppose it there are arguments, therefore, for having some element of storage at the end of it. And it seems to be, from what you're saying, I'm not quite sure whether you're using liquid or gas hydrogen at the end of the line, but it seems to be that you're putting an element of storage. And also, from what you're saying, that electrolysis is actually occurring on the island as well. And is that from onshore wind as well, John? Am I right in thinking that you've got onshore wind linked up to electrolyzers on Orkney?
Yes, that's currently how the systems are working.
And that is then stored how?
So at the moment, the hydrogen is stored as a compressed gas, which suits the logistics operations that are in place right now.
Yeah.
There are plans recently announced by NES Energy and one of the local wind farms here to establish a green ammonia production.
Yeah.
Which should open up some alternative possibilities as well, for as ammonia is far easier to store and transport, and whilst it has got its own issues, it does offer another opportunity to explore how we can move this zero carbon fuel around.
Yeah, would that be as a liquid, in a liquid format, in some kind of a container?
Yes.
And then it would be taken out of the ammonia, so the ammonia would be used as some kind of carrier, and then it would be converted back, would it, or would it be used in its ammonia?
That's the idea, yes. Yeah. So you liberate the hydrogen from the ammonia molecule.
And you also mentioned a heating element in there. And when I was reading through the Scottish Energy strategy, and there's quite a strong emphasis on heat. I think the bigger feeling regarding net zero is that we've made great strides on the electricity side, which is great. But if we're going to make substantial routes forward to net zero, we have to look at the the gas grid, which obviously by the sounds of it you're well advanced on, and also on the heating side. And are you talking about heating to schools and to buildings here with the heating side of things? How does that work?
Within the Orkney context, yes, it is currently confined to a school on one of the islands, Chapinsay, that's currently has fuel oil as the main heating source, but it will incorporate the hydrogen as a backup. And so that should be commissioned any time now and operational. Further afield, if you think about the take the islands as an example of off-grid heating. One of the big issues surrounding that, and certainly something that resonates with the Orkney community, is fuel poverty.
Yeah.
And when you check out the statistics, with over 60% of the properties or folk up here registered as being in fuel poverty, that presents some real challenges. And that's defined as having 10% or more of your income going out on your energy bills. In this case, heating is a huge component of the energy bills, impacted by the quality of housing, impacted by income from salary levels up here, impacted by the weather conditions, and also impacted by the fuel prices, which do incur surcharges in many occasions, given the fuel has to be transported extra distances to reach the islands. So all those factors do combine, and this does present some real challenges. How do you decarbonise the heating of properties on islands facing those sorts of obstacles? This is not an easy challenge to overcome.
Yeah, and I suppose, I mean, there's the Hindenburg legacy, I suppose, of hydrogen. I suppose if you go to any meeting, I'm sure you go to a meeting and people will raise this, and it's a rather scary image, whether or not hydrogen was involved is a moot point, but people perhaps believe it was. So I would imagine there's a bit of an education piece for stakeholders and the community right up front of the process. Not everybody's going to go with something that, I mean, it might be expensive to get fuel oil to the islands, but people familiar with it, something's a known. And then somebody comes along and says, well, actually, we're going to trial hydrogen. How was that addressed?
So public awareness is absolutely, you're spot on. It's a huge amount of work that needs to be done as this transition takes place towards a full-blown hydrogen economy. And it's not just Orkney, it's any of the other locations globally where hydrogen is being explored. Yes, you're absolutely right when I talk about hydrogen to a new audience. The first image that springs to mind is either a Led Zeppelin album cover or a large mushroom cloud. That's ingrained in our psyche. However, when you contrast that with an example, that if you look at a refueling station, there were two incidents last year that were both well publicised. The 1,500 associated incidents with regular filling stations didn't even make much news at all.
Yeah.
So are we dealing with something that is dangerous? Yes, we are. Is it as dangerous as things currently in use at the moment? Yes. However, we've got used to using those other fuels. We've got safety systems in. And there is a maxim that I do quote from a very dear friend of mine in the sector, which is whatever we do has to be as safe or better than what we're currently doing.
Yeah.
And with that sort of message in there and demonstrating what we're doing, the levels of safety and the procedures and policies that we're putting in place, it has to be as safe or better than what we're currently doing. Otherwise, we're just not going to get that public buy-in.
Yeah. I think there's something down at Keele University as well, working on the safety side. I think the results have been very, very impressive in the first year as well. And as people get more familiar with it, I mean, we already move dangerous stuff around. If you think about some of the fuels and things like that, it's always something that we're already familiar with, moving hazardous materials around. And it's going to be no different with hydrogen, which is perhaps better in some respects. It's got some different characteristics, but some favourable characteristics as well, the way it dissipates and so forth, even the much publicised Hindenburg, which come across time and time again. Was it really hydrogen? Was it really actually something else that that caused that? But clearly, you've made good progress on the public perception side. But there are an awful lot of other stakeholders to bring along on a project of as integrated as you managed to do on Orkney. And thinking about on the domestic scale and in the schools and so forth, I would imagine there's a whole heap of stakeholders with something to say on elements such as that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And there have been many, many engagement events with local communities, the school, and at each stage, you know, the projects are advanced. There's regular communication, discussions, and any of these issues are talked through and resolved. And I have to pay tribute at this point to the council, Orkney Islands Council, and the work they're doing, because they are supremely engaged in this and have dedicated resource out regularly, working with the community, working with the schools in particular. You know, it's really important that as they understand their energy transition, of which hydrogen is going to be a key part, that they are not just shown but actively engaging and showing the community this is the way we want to go and we believe in it.
Yeah, and it seems to be now something they must be aware of how much of a trailblazer it is, because I'm sure 2 or 3 years ago there weren't all these hydrogen strategies and roadmaps and all these things being published almost on a weekly basis. And now when people look and say, well, because talk is quite cheap in many respects, but when they want an actual basis of something that's actually been delivered, the thoughts must alight upon Orkney and say, well, look, if you want to see something that is integrated and is working and up and running and it seems to have gone well, there is a classic example to show at least proof of concept.
And that's exactly what the Orkney projects are about, demonstrating what can be achieved. And the integration projects are so far unique, but you now see in all these reports, right, this is how we're going to do it. And we're now starting to see the big investment markets moving and recognising that, and again, this is something you'll read daily in the papers at the moment, this green transition that's happening with massive increases in renewable expenditure. Aligned with that is hydrogen expenditure. And with what's been announced in Germany, I believe Europe will be hot on the heels with their hydrogen strategy. Australia is making massive strides in this space as well. And I have to say, from the position I'm in now, working as a consultant in the field, the numbers that are being discussed and the finance that's being put forward for these projects is eye-watering.
Yeah.
But absolutely, it's nothing other than encouraging that we can make this transition, we can achieve those 2050 targets. And, we can do what is necessary to make sure that our humble little species can survive this climate change monster that we're having to face at the moment.
Yeah, it's interesting because before the chat started, you described a kind of bucolic scene of looking out of the window and the sheep being sheared, and it was like almost in a bygone age. But actually, when you think dispassionately, if you want something that is scalable, which is obviously of interest to the utilities and the oil and gas companies who are coming into the sector and the nations and the regions. But from that scene that you described at the start, you do have something, I think you said, was a world leadership, and people from heavily industrialized landscapes with deep pockets and big aspirations are looking, because they know from what you've achieved, you've shown proof of concept, and you can also say, well, actually, the principles work now. It's just a case of making it work, going out, and scaling it as well. And I suppose one thing that we've not touched upon is the cost of this, because it does sound slightly counterintuitive to put sometimes more energy in than you take out of a system. But that's not unusual for a utility, for example. That happens all the time with various bits of tech. But I suppose one thing, coming from an offshore wind background, which is my background, we encountered the same things. People were very scared, and there's always pictures of nacelles on fire, which didn't play well, but you've got to put that into context. And you know, like, yeah, once it's a mechanical, it will fail, but nobody was hurt. It was a bit of smoke and it looked very dramatic. But actually, the safety record was very comparable, very good in comparison to other tech. And the industry's kicked on from almost a niche to becoming almost as overheated as I suppose you could say that hydrogen is becoming something everybody wants to be involved in offshore wind. Not many people have done it. The UK, to an extent, has. It's been a bit of a trailblazer itself. And we're now starting to see, I suppose, synergies. Could some of the wind, the overspill, wind generates 24/7, could that be used rather than a loose grid, rather than project it down the grid and use it at times that are not convenient? Could it be stored, and could it be used when people really want it? And so there are big synergies now between offshore wind, which was a niche and not quite ridiculed, but it was certainly marginalised and rejected by many people, many eminent people. But that's now mainstream. And people are now starting to look, could we kind of synthesize and are there synergies with hydrogen production? And you've already mentioned, I think, EMEC, and you mentioned, I think, Tidal. What about the ScotWind round, John? What are your views on how things are shaping up in ScotWind and other leasing rounds as well?
Well, I think you're absolutely right with the journey that offshore wind has been on. And I think in terms of offering that transition from fossil fuel generated electricity to renewable electricity, offshore wind is, you know, the prize that we need to pursue and indeed win. The issue, of course, with it, it's renewable, it has an intermittency issue, and also it's not being generated centrally. You know, we are generating at the ends of the spokes, so alternative models and technologies are necessary, and indeed investments to get those electrons to market. And something I started talking about last year on the conference circuit before we all shifted to webinars was something I referred to as electron stewardship, which is if you've gone to the trouble of making an electron, you know, you should do your best to use that electron rather than, you know, consuming electrons, making it into something else. So that's great. However, where you have an intermittent supply and a variable grid, the need to manage not just your supply side but also your demand side then starts to become far more important, and energy storage to balance that network and make sure you are able to provide electricity when you need to. Storage is key to that, and you know, there are many eminent and very well qualified people out there will discuss the various merits and demerits of different battery systems and indeed hydrogen. My view on all of this is that we need every single tool we've got in the box at the moment to enable us to transition away from the fossil fuels and meet those climate change obligations. So yes, offshore wind, really important. Hydrogen, key part of the story, along with batteries. And what I think is interesting is that if you do transition to hydrogen and view that as a power to gas transaction, you then have an opportunity to move your energy into different infrastructures and therefore decarbonize different systems. So it's a very, very versatile energy carrier, and that's certainly how I would see hydrogen as we step forward from demonstration projects now into a very harsh, very real commercial reality.
Yeah, you've got some almost counterintuitive things starting to happen out there in industry. And one of them, of course, is that oil and gas is itself looking to decarbonize. And I suppose if you think about the Scottish industry as well, and you think about other technological advances such as floating wind, which can perhaps go into deeper waters and perhaps be a bit less site governed, you might start to think, well, actually, are there now joined up schemes involving oil and gas installations and assets, floating offshore wind, and hydrogen as well, and which would knock out some of the grid constraints and enable an industry that is carbon based to itself decarbonize. It sounds fanciful, but I think it's a number of companies and countries are indeed looking at just that.
I would say it's far from fanciful. And I'll be as blunt as that. These sorts of schemes are being actively discussed. costed out and evaluated as very real solutions.
Yeah, and they've been done by on a big scale.
Absolutely, and you know, I really support these initiatives. They're really exciting. There's some big engineering challenges, and you know, it's great working with a big engineering team supporting what the work I'm doing, and understanding what those challenges are. This is not trivial, any of this. But then we've done non-trivial stuff now for decades and decades.
Yeah,
it's frontier pioneer stuff, but it's doable, I think.
Yeah, I think a German minister came up with a phrase that stuck in John Massey and my mind. She called for a Cape Canaveral for hydrogen, which I thought just gave an indication of kind of the scale of endeavour. Involved, if you're serious about this, we know now, as you've described, the principle clearly works. It's just a case of now of scaling it. One thing we learned from offshore wind is that things came on the back of it because it was niche and it was very expensive at the start. It certainly wasn't the cheapest energy source, but it became that as the scale went up and we learned where the costs were and how to drive down some of the costs, a lot of the turbine costs, standardization, bigger machines, getting the cost of money borrowing itself down. We found some synergies within the grid itself. And the cost has now come down remarkably to, I think I was at SSE not that long ago, and we said, well, look, £100 a megawatt hour is absolutely impossible, can't be done. And I think on the latest leasing round in England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and Wales, it was under £40 per megawatt hour. So it's less than half of what we, not so long ago, deemed to be impossible. So we know that scaling can work. It can reduce costs. Do you think there's something similar with hydrogen? I mean, it's not cheap. It's priced per kilogram as opposed to per megawatt hour. But do you see that if you were to kind of scale up, you could reduce the cost of hydrogen itself?
I'm confident that's going to happen, and indeed the discussions I have periodically with the key electrolyzer suppliers indicate that they see this trajectory as well. Right now they're producing electrolyzers at single to double digit megawatt scale. You mentioned earlier projects in the gigawatt scale. Well, if you're going to supply electrolyzers with very large, I'll call it lump, that's a highly technical word, let's say multiple tens of megawatts, you've upscaled, and going from the very local case of a 500 kilowatt system up to what's now I guess the standard lump of 5 megawatts, up to maybe 50 megawatts in the not too distant future, you see the scale at which these things are increasing. And this is a trajectory that's happened as well in the wind sector, both onshore and offshore, that upscaling. And with that upscaling does come standardization. You know, at the moment, systems are bespoke, designed to meet the requirements of a system. If you can go out and buy almost off the shelf 10 megawatt lumps of electrolyzer, that means you've got standardization of design, assembly, you can reduce a lot of your costs there. And that does present some real opportunities to drive the cost down, which I fully expect to happen over the next 5 years, certainly.
Yeah, and if you look at some countries are putting a stake in the ground as to be early adopters, if you like, and I think China and Germany both spring to mind. I suppose they, by putting these strategies into place, they encourage the market and say, look, this is our trajectory. And the German one was particularly interesting with its emphasis on green hydrogen as well, which is obviously renewably based, and that seems to be more or less what's happening at Orkney as well. So you could say that actually Orkney is a blueprint for the German hydrogen strategy. You're taking the lessons learned from what you've put in place and worked on a much, much bigger scale, and that scale will then help drive the cost, and that will then further encourage investors to come to the market. It's going to further encourage innovation and further encourage deployment of the technologies.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I applaud what's going on in Germany. I've done a lot of applauding during this discussion, but it is great to see in the time I've been involved to shift from it being niche demonstrator, good thing to chat about at conferences, to becoming mainstream. And when you see, you know, 7 billion that the German government have pledged to, you know, this scale of investment, this is just, you know, eye-watering sums of money now going in.
Yeah.
And that needs to be spent to enable the, you know, the technology to upscale, enable factories to be built, enable engineers to be trained and brought forward, and so on. And I think it's just so exciting.
I agree. It would sound almost fanciful, but I've seen the exact same trajectory happen in wind, where it was an expensive, I think the E.ON came up with this great phrase, they called it a boutique. So the wind farms went from boutique, and you're talking about 6, 8, 10 megawatt wind farms, to I think they're talking about 14 megawatt turbines. That's per turbine now, which when they so these are mega structures by anybody's imagination. A third of a kilometer high, and there's a lot of them being proposed. It's not just ScotWind, but we've got German leasing rounds, Dutch leasing rounds. I think the Danes are coming back in. You name it, and people are going to come back into it, which is further. So the two. Again, offshore wind and indeed all forms of wind and renewables and hydrogen seem to be a particularly good combination to, I suppose, what I'm getting at is that when we started out in wind, we didn't have climate change. We did have them, they were loose, but they've been firmed up, some of the policies, and more recently with the net zero aspirations. If you're serious about wanting to get to net zero by 2050, and a lot of places are a lot in advance of that, then you've got to go now and you've got to go big. And I can see hydrogen being integral into getting as to that journey to net zero.
Mm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thinking of some of the challenges that you faced, John, over the last few years, what kind of things, were there any unexpected things that, well, there's always things crop up in projects, but was there anything that kind of bamboozled you, thought, oh, we didn't see that one wasn't on the top of the risk register, something like that, come and surprise you?
I think the biggest challenge has been around regulation.
Yeah.
And it's a bit unfair to point fingers. However, if we are going to decarbonise the maritime sector and meet the obligations of the IMO by 2050, then that's a sector that has really got to work hard now to enable new technologies to move in. And be adopted. And I'm thinking here about the safe movement of hydrogen, whether it's moved on a trailer, cylinders, or indeed in a hydrogen vehicle, where you've got hydrogen in the tank, in inverted commas. These sorts of things need working through, and pretty fast. So we understand really these safety cases, so we can go back with just a set of proposals. That's done. We've sorted it. Let's move on, and let's focus now on upscaling and enabling technology to move forward. So that was certainly something that I hadn't envisaged us spending as much time on as has been done.
Yeah.
I think also understanding the complexity of some of the hydrogen projects that have been worked on. You think in your case, you know, wind turbine, you know, you've got the blades, you've got, you know, a conversion system from one form of energy to another, and then wires. With the hydrogen systems, yes, they are all pipes and wires, but the complexity of what's going on in the electrolyzer stacks and how you ensure those are operated effectively with water purification, hydrogen purification at the other end, management of the electrical engineering. These have not been trivial systems to develop, and I think as those systems do standardize, the learning certainly we've had within the Orkney projects will enable those suppliers to, you know, get there faster and make that transition quicker. So I think the time it's taken.
Coming back to, I mean, looking at that, I mean, if you want a harsh environment, we said that the Orkney might have an enviable wind speed resource, but I suppose the flip side of that is that it's quite a harsh environment to have people working and people in vessels and people things like offshore wind. Every schoolboy knows that electricity and water don't necessarily go together. And then we are talking about building massive wind farms out in sea in harsh environments, and these things can be up to a third of a kilometer high, and then there's additional complexity on top of that. So the regulation, I suppose, was from a bygone age for solving different problems when the national grid was onshore and people didn't worry about regulations 100 miles off sea. It was largely irrelevant at the time, but the people looking at the space and the sea in a different way now and start to see it as a resource, an opportunity. And sometimes I suppose the regulation hasn't necessarily kept track of it and kept up with that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Whether it's the gas grid, the electricity grid, or any of the networks we've got, the rule books were written quite some time ago, and understanding how those need to be adopted to meet the changes and the transition that we're working through right now. That's not a trivial piece of work.
No, I suppose if you're going to start having these highfalutin national strategies and roadmaps and all the rest of it, number one is to look at that, the regulatory side of it. I hope they've all got that incorporated. The ones, to be honest, that I've looked at, the Dutch ones, certainly was very pragmatic, very broken down into bite-sized chunks, if you like, and I think number one was on that the safety and the regulatory side. And then it was also, you don't proceed to number two until you've nailed effectively number one. So you can have all the strategies in the world, but unless you've got the basics in place, shown, then perhaps number three and number four might be a bit nebulous. So don't start rushing off and mobilizing supply chains and things for the big picture stuff until you've got the basics in place. And some of that might be pretty unglamorous. People tend not to be that interested in regulatory workshops and things like that, but it is a vital part of the bigger picture and getting to net zero.
I had just a related example to that. There is a standard for the natural gas that runs through our pipelines. This is anecdotal through a friend of mine. Absolutely, please feel free to edit this bit out if it's not factually correct. I was told that it requires an act of parliament to change that specification. Right. And whether that's correct or not, as I say, please edit that bit out. But if that is correct, that's one specification that affects the shows the enormity of the task ahead.
We found all kinds of things when we looked at that in wind, when you started to look at the codes and the regulations, and things were absolutely impossible. Sometimes a blind eye was discreetly turned to certain things. But when you have certainly some of the big inquiries, they can sort of mutate into an area you don't expect them to go in. And I certainly know that some of the ones off the Aberdeen, when I think the Trump lawyers were looking at some of the things regarding regulation, and it made uncomfortable viewing sometimes for the wind farm developers and so forth. They did get there, and it took time. And time obviously equals delay and equals cost. But I suppose on the plus side of delay, it also enabled the tech to evolve and the tech to get better. So by the time things like Seagreen, for example, off our Broth comes out with its rejig turbine size, it's going to be a far, far better scheme. The basics was put in place 10 years ago, and that's what it can take with these major projects. But it's not trivial. And sometimes things can come from a regulatory source and knock the project back years, which is hard for developers. And it's particularly hard when I've been involved with things like local supply chain and local content, and you want to encourage people to see the opportunity and say, look, think about this. And then it gets bogged down for years in some arcane discussion about bird migration or something that most people don't follow that closely. It's what's happening to it. Where's it going? Oh, I'm going to do something else instead. From the Orkney side of it, it seems to be that you've got the engagement locally. People can see the benefits of having this hydrogen economy, if you like, on the ground.
Yes, simple answer to a long preamble there. You're right, and I think what I'm seeing with the other projects I'm working on right now, public engagement is increasingly a large component of any of these proposals, and whether that's hydrogen production or those areas, regions that are looking at deployment of hydrogen technologies. There is a recognition this is not simply about shifting technology A to technology B.
Yeah.
Why would people make that transition You have to look at socialising the benefits. You've got to look at that public buy-in. You've got to have a full set of stakeholders completely sold on this and understanding, because there is a great collective wisdom now, and the power of social media to influence and shape things is enormous nowadays. Yeah. So you will always get someone who projects ABC in a location, the first thing that will come up will be a picture of the Hindenburg. Don't want this because. And that's a really good entry point to say, well, if you'll talk to me, let's work through this. Yeah. And if you still feel that way at the end, then that means we still have more work to do. Take it from that direction. I think as an allied point, we're talking about public awareness, if you don't mind me digressing for a moment. And that's about training and skills development.
Yeah.
And moving into this new world. Let's take an example of petrol and diesel vehicles. That's what we're used to. And we pop down the road and the garage fixes things for us. And we carry on, don't we? We're used to that infrastructure. Even with electric vehicles, you have to go to specialised dealers now. If you have a hydrogen vehicle, how many people are actually equipped to service a hydrogen vehicle right now? It's very, very few indeed. So rolling out not just a infrastructure, but servicing and maintenance technicians who can deal with this new technology. And that's one example of many, because hydrogen has the potential to be quite ubiquitous. If the trials that you mentioned at Kiel are successful, as I'm sure they will be, and the transition towards some percentage of hydrogen in the gas grid goes forward, what do we need to do to transition boilers and cookers? What about those industrial demands that are currently burning natural gas and want to transition to hydrogen? How do we accommodate those with the right number of people and skilled people trained and equipped so they can do enable that transition to happen, install the kit safely, and make sure that we can do the next stage without incident? It's really, really important that we address that. And chatting to the Scottish Government, they've certainly got plans later this year to do some work in that area and really understand what we need by way of skills, training, qualifications to make sure that we're equipped to make that transition.
You're dead right. When, again, coming back to offshore wind, where there are similarities, one of the most popular things that we offered for a kind of community benefit was apprentices and apprentices training in the new kit that is going to be out there, so that the local community benefits really meant something on the ground. Is that something that you've addressed already? Do you have a local kind of O&M capability for the various bits of kit that you've described earlier? How do you maintain it and how do you keep it ticking over?
Really good question. So there has been a reliance on the equipment providers to support with maintenance, but of course access to site, if you're bringing an engineer over from Germany, that can be a 24-hour journey to get here, and if you haven't brought the right spanner with you, that creates sometimes can create a problem. Certainly, I know that those who are operating and running the kit are recruiting engineers and training engineers and developing people to take on those responsibilities.
Yeah.
I think as some of the kit is still, I'll say, demonstration, there is a need to have the primary manufacturers engaged in appropriate service level agreements so that they can maintain critical components if replacements are needed.
Yeah, and
what has happened, though, is in the maritime sector, so I think we had a slight satellite delay on that one. In the maritime space, the local college, Orkney College, have been developing training courses for the crews to make sure they're well equipped to deal with any incidents that may happen. So it's an awareness of hydrogen, safety cases around that, and indeed how to handle incidents related to hydrogen, which includes firefighting.
And is that on Orkney?
There's been a lot of effort put into those courses.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. That's the local college that's been providing those. There's also been some work feeding into a number of national schemes, looking at developing specific hydrogen qualifications. So it's all, it's starting to move in the right direction. And I think it's one of those chicken and egg scenarios. But if we the greater we, Scottish government and the UK government, make that commitment to, you know, a national rollout of hydrogen infrastructure, whatever that's going to look like, that has to be accompanied by a timeline to ensure we've got the right number of engineers, fitters, technicians available. And what's nice is we have a new skill set developing, you know, as hydrogen engineers, and it's a wonderful fusion of, I used the term earlier, pipes and wires, but to find and develop people who are skilled in managing gases and electricity and high pressures. These are quite sophisticated skill sets that need to be brought together. These people are going to be well qualified and highly capable and really, really valuable.
Yeah, and I suppose if you were looking, if you were involved in the oil and gas sector, you might already have some of that skill set. I've heard this phrase sector coupling regarding hydrogen as well. It does bring together people that perhaps, certainly in offshore wind, we never used to really talk with people like the chemical industry or even the nuclear industry, but all kinds of people seem to be coming together because they can all see some benefit to their particular industry with hydrogen as an element of it. You mentioned ammonia, where you can see perhaps the fertilizer and the chemical industries being interested in that. You look at oil and gas, we've talked about with the refineries with hydrogen already used, and some of the other industries out there are quite pro hydrogen, and they bring skills to the skill set that you mentioned. They, some of the skills already exist out there. They might need tweaking and amending for the new skills that are going to be needed if there is to be a hydrogen based economy.
Yeah, and violence agreement with everything you've just said. The role I currently have, I'm chatting to all sorts of people across different sectors throughout the day, and that's, you know, a great thrill. And this is what I'm seeing now is learning that, you know, the oil and gas sector are volunteering most information. Say we've got skills in this area.
Yeah.
How can we use those to drive this transition forward? And that's been a complete shift from a couple of years ago. And recognizing that the world is changing. Yeah. Everyone's becoming an energy company now. And you know, that there is that that view that we can pull together to make this happen, because we're going to need, as I said earlier, every tool in the box to achieve those climate change targets and do what's necessary to, you know, avoid getting that 1.5 degree temperature rise. We've got to work hard, we've got to work fast, and we've got to work together if we're going to make this happen.
Well, and that I think that is a pretty good summation, John, of where we I was going to ask you to sum up, because we've talked about a lot of issues in the last 45 minutes, last hour or so, and a lot of things we've touched upon. But if you were to summarize it, and you were to summarize where we are, I always think we're on the basis for takeoff with regards to the proof of concept is there. You've proved it largely. All the pieces seem to fit together. There's still a bit of regulation, but it's inconceivable to my mind that some of these strategies wouldn't solve the regulatory challenges ahead. And I suppose one of the differences is there's a lot of people talking about the subject, but delivering it. If anybody delivered it, it's people like yourselves on Orkney that have done that and shown that it can be done. And so if you were to sum up where we're at now and where we're going to be, what would you say?
So I think right now we are just about to start riding the crest of a very big hydrogen wave.
Yeah.
And you'll see over the next 5 years a huge amount of projects moving very rapidly through feasibility study through to initial deployments. During that time, you'll see significant upscaling of the technologies implementation. So I'm expecting that by 2030, we will have some of these big projects live delivering and showing what's possible. Hydrogen, I think, will come into its real shining glory from 2030 onwards. And there's a lot of forecasts out there that would also support that. So it's a medium-term prognosis, if you like. And I think in terms of, you know, what I'd like to see happen, again, it's something I used at a conference when I was put on the spot about public awareness last year. And I coined the phrase, we need to make hydrogen boring. right now, everyone's talking about hydrogen. Everyone, it's a real buzz around the sector, and everyone's hydrogen this, hydrogen that, hydrogen the other. Let's have a paper. Let's have a strategy. Yeah. At the moment, you know, when you get up in the morning, you know, you have your shower, you boil your cup of tea, and we're back to normal. You know, you'd be driving around in vehicles and just getting on with your daily life, taking everything for granted in the energy system that's going on around us. Right now, there's a real buzz with, you know, transitioning from fossil fuels to renewables. You know, what's the role for hydrogen? Where's batteries, new vehicles, and so on? So there's a lot of interest in that. At some point, we'll drift back to normality. At that point, you know, all this buzz starts to be run of the mill, quite mundane, quite boring. At that point, hopefully we've achieved net zero. Hopefully we've achieved our climate change objectives. And hopefully at that point, when I hang up my spurs at the end of all this journey, we will have really made hydrogen very, very boring. And that's, it's kind of a thing to put on my tombstone, I suppose. but yeah, if we've achieved that in the next sort of 10, 15 years, fantastic, because we've done our work.
Wow. You know, John Clixham, I don't think there's any better summary of where we're at now. Thank you very much indeed for engaging with us on the Chinwag today. Sadly, we lost John Massey as a vagary of the tech. When I started out in IT at one time, the internet was very excited and things like telematics were buzzing and exciting. And now it is almost boring. It's a utility like any other. And I suppose that is a success of where we've come to on IT and comms. Dr. Massey's exception, proving the rule on that. But I'd like to thank, on behalf of John, and I thank you very much indeed, John Clixham, for sparing the time to talk with us on our Chinwag today. Thank you very much indeed, John.
Great pleasure. Thank you both. Excellent. Bye-bye. Yeah.